Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we're back with another great episode here for you on the show. And I can't wait to get started in this one. It's going to be looking at a little bit of more of our winter topics this week, and that's going to be bringing in our resident winter rescue expert, Kyle Nelson, in a little bit. But first off, we've got to bring Sam Bradley in here. Sam, you know, we've had a bunch of stuff going on. I know when we record this, it's actually the polar vortex week. So for some of you, you'll be hearing this as past tense, but boy, it's getting cold.
You bet. And Kyle is in his element up there in Aspen. So Joe, how's the weather been down in Memphis?
Not too bad. I've actually been in Las Vegas, so much nicer there.
It's always nice in Vegas. So let's just jump into this, Kylie. We have a couple of topics we want to cover with you, but you just finished the X Games, and we want to hear all about that.
Oh, my goodness, Sam. Yes, we just wrapped up the 2019 edition of the Winter X Games in Aspen, Colorado. I was very fortunate this year to work with a fantastic team of all medical providers from various backgrounds and disciplines to support the athlete medical and spectator medical side of things at the X Games. So on the ski patrol side, and I'll talk about the other one just briefly, on the ski patrol side, I was, again, the coordinator for ski patrol for Winter X Games on behalf of Aspen Ski Company. And essentially, that looks to coordinate and help facilitate a seamless standard of care between Aspen Ski Patrols, as well as Aspen EMS and other ambulance providers in the Valley, a group called Medicine in Motion, who are athletic trainers that ESPN will bring in addition to the ESPN doctors, several of which are from the East Coast. So Joel Buzzy, as well as Dr. Van Wee, as well, that work out there in Maryland. So two awesome docs that help coordinate the spectator and athlete medical side of things. But this year, we were very, very fortunate. We did not have any ambulance transports directly from the field of play to the ambulance. Some of those came later after those athletes were evaluated on other medical rooms on site. But we had a great team this year, and it was a ton of fun. The weather was a little brutal on the first day. We had the first day that we had to be on course, there were 8 inches of snow overnight. So we had to kind of dust off and kind of dig out some of our gear that we had pre-staged. But the rest of the week went great, and it was wonderful to see the Valley all come together to support this event.
So for those that don't know, Kyle, and I got to try to remember from last year, what do they do in the X Games?
Well, Sam, the X absolutely does stand for extreme. So the Winter X Games comprises several kind of, how shall I say, several activities that have stood the test of time and that people love to see year in year, such as the Big Air jump, where athletes will launch down from a launch ramp, both skiers and snowboarders, men and women, which is absolutely fantastic. The Big Air, they'll launch down there, they'll go off a jump at about 45 miles an hour, do some stunts in the air, and land on a very, very tall and steep slope on down to the corral where they're getting cheered on by the crowd. That's one that's always a pleaser. Another one is the super pipe. So think of that as a very, very long, very wide super pipe that is 22 feet from the deck, the lip of the deck on the pipe, the sides of it, to the bottom. So just think about mechanism of injury right there when the athletes are going 15 to 20 feet above the pipe lip with their aerial stunts and things. So that's, of course, always a fun one to watch. And, of course, the slope-style course where you have three rail features followed by three big jumps going down there. So any number of things that could occur on and throughout that course. And all the while, you also have, we cannot forget, our snowmobile and recently snow bike venue. So if you haven't heard of snowmobiles, pretty easy to identify. But snow bikes, if you Google timber sled, think about a dirt bike with a big ski on the front instead of a front tire, and then like a track on the back of it. So like a snowmobile track on the back. Those things are super awesome, and they've really dialed those up in recent years. And so you have both human-powered and mechanical mechanisms to transport these athletes up, down, and all around. And so it really makes for a fun event to watch, but also a big, big potential for high-impact events with, say, some of our events where, like in the snow bike venue, with some of the races, we have about 12 riders on course at any one time. So you could also be talking mass casualty incident if things devolve. But thankfully, again, these are professional athletes. They're the best of the best of what they do, and we're there to help them if they need.
Joe, you have a question.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by these snow bikes. I'm not actually familiar with those. Is that sort of like motocross on snow, Kyle? Is that a good way to describe that?
That's a great way to describe it. So it's not necessarily like a studded tire, like some of you may remember from the earlier days of X Games, when they actually had just dirt bikes with studded tires. But this is actually where you take the front and back tires off of a dirt bike. You put a big ski on the front of it and a big snowmobile type track on the back of it. So you could ride it through the course like they have, but increasingly people are taking these into backcountry and wilderness areas to explore because it's a little bit, it's lighter and a little bit easier to handle than a snowmobile.
So Kyle, you got lucky this year in terms of accidents and so forth, but I can see that one little miscalculation can cause some serious trauma. What kind of events have you dealt with in the past?
Well, this year, we did have a few responses on the slope-style course. Those were for some distal extremity injuries, so wrists, elbows, as well as some knee injuries as well. Last year, it was actually Saturday night, the last big event, the men's snowboard superpipe. The athlete, I cannot pronounce his name, so I'm going to use his nickname, iPod, and he miscalculated a stunt on his final hit in the superpipe, ended up falling backwards, hitting his head, knocking himself out, and we had to respond to that. That was a very serious situation. A couple years prior, the year before that, in the snowmobile venue, and we had snowmobile, I believe it was freestyle, Caleb Moore attempted a trick where he actually ended up injuring his back. And the year before that, we had a athlete on the slope style course not land a jump correctly on one of our big jump features further down in the line, and he ended up knocking himself unconscious on course. So all the way from that to some humeral fractures and other things like that. So we've had quite the gambit of things.
Big ouch. Jamie, thoughts or questions from you?
It just always amazes me that the things that people come up with and to do, and it's exciting to watch. Certainly, the times that I've been able to catch the X Games on TV and whatnot, and whether it's winter or summertime, it's always been pretty spectacular to see some of the stunts that people are capable of. But each time you push that envelope, you take a certain additional level of risk and add it into the mix. And it's good to know that people like Kyle and his fellow responders are right there to bring their services to bear as necessary in these specialized situations, because you do have that increased risk.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And that's one of the big things. And we can't forget the over 1,000 workers that it takes to put this on. And if it's anything above the base area during the daytime, ski patrol is going to be first on scene for that within the venue. And we've had workers get injured in the past. I mean, all the scaffolding, the electrical and everything else that's going on, driving snowmobiles through the venue. You never know what could happen, but we're always there and ready.
Well, speaking of additional dangers, and yes, this is a segue, have you ever had any issues with avalanches where you have the X Games set up?
So not within the X Games venue. That is, in all honesty, it's pretty much solid ice. That venue is, its majority of it is man-made or machine-made snow, I should say. And that gets packed down to a very, very, very firm surface. So if you think the deck of the super pipe, I could just on ski boots alone slide down the edge of that because it is so slick and so firm. And with all the traffic on it, it gets packed down. So we don't have the avalanche risk there, but in areas adjacent to the X Games venue surrounding Aspen, throughout the mountains of Colorado, absolutely you have avalanche risk. And it's actually higher in this year than in previous years because of our increased snowfall as well as wetter snow that we've had. And so I guess, Sam, that kind of brings us to our avalanche discussion here tonight.
Yeah, good segue, huh? So let's talk avalanches and what's going on with them. What kind of incidents have we had this year, and what does ski patrollers do about it?
Well, Sam, avalanches, they are probably one of the scariest things that any human being could ever experience. I've known many patrollers that have taken rides, as we like to say, during control work activities where we're working either to throw explosives to try to create avalanches or actually skiing across the slope ourselves to try to trigger them as humans. But avalanches, though, are they can be very, very destructive on the upper end or even on the low end. They can just be little sloughs, little slides of snow on steeper slopes that don't cause any damage at all. So it runs the gambit from no impact to severe impact and even destroying buildings and other infrastructure as well. But kind of to put things in perspective, and across the United States, there have been 11 avalanche fatalities so far this season, compared to 24 as a total last season. So we're about halfway there, right about halfway through ski season, at least recreational ski season, I should say, lift served in the majority of the U.S. And in Colorado, close to my home, we actually had one skier, a very, very well-known local, caught, buried, and killed last week while backcountry touring outside of Aspen. And we've had two avalanche fatalities total so far this season in Colorado. And I have the, unfortunate privilege of actually working in Pitkin County, which sadly leads Colorado in avalanche deaths by county. We have a huge population that loves to get out and explore in the backcountry, whether on foot or slash on skis, or via snow machine. And as people continue to push the boundaries of the sport, have easy access to the equipment, and put themselves further and further out in these avalanche-prone areas, I expect that we may see those numbers increase. However, we'll talk about the education side and how we can help decrease those numbers.
Yeah, that would be a good thing. So I assume that most of the avalanches that get triggered are when people are out of bounds from the ski slopes, correct?
Correct. There have been inbounds avalanches, and that's actually not uncommon in Colorado. Ski areas work diligently to assess and evaluate and then mitigate the avalanche hazard, but the avalanche hazard, even inbounds of a ski area, is never truly zero. We do the best that we can with the tools and the information that we have as patrollers, but as people continue to explore and, you know, as the science evolves, we'll definitely get better with mitigating that risk, but it can never truly be zero. So you may see some folks or take some heat. And I know I have personally skiing at resorts, both here in Aspen and across Colorado. It's like, oh, you're skiing inbounds. Why are you bringing this gear with you? These beacons, these shovels, these probes, these avalanche rescue tools, why are you bringing them with you if you're skiing inbounds? Well, the potential is absolutely still there.
Or you're going to be going in looking for somebody else. Joe, what do you think about all this? You don't get much snow in Memphis, I realize.
I don't, and I have done some very rudimentary avalanche rescue training as part of our USAR stuff, but it's been many years. So I've been fascinated in listening to Kyle kind of refresh my memory on many of the terms and the issues surrounding it. So keep on going. I'm getting educated again.
Well, and I have a question for you, Kyle, because I've seen some things on, you know, different programs and articles that I've seen that on some technologies that are out there to serve as rescue aids, perhaps as survival aids until rescue can be effected. Can you talk a little bit about what's out there that is truly effective, that isn't a gimmick, that isn't something that, you know, they just try to sell to a skier to make some money?
Well, Jamie, before we touch on rescue tech, let's talk about what kills people in avalanches and kind of how some of that rescue tech can address some of those, those challenges.
Perfect.
So in an avalanche accident, it really presents a unique issue, or a unique challenge for rescue workers. Asphyxia is the most common cause of mortality with avalanche victims in about 75% of total avalanche deaths on record. And I emphasize on record because there are some that are not discovered or not reported. It occurs whether the person will inhale snow or other debris blocks the airway. I've talked with survivors of avalanches, and it's literally you can hold your mouth closed and clench your teeth as tight as you can, but that avalanche, that snow, as it's sliding down the mountain, is trying to force snow into any opening in the body, especially the mouth. You could also be asphyxiated by if you become entrapped in that avalanche debris. As you exhale that warm, moist air, that water vapor will actually freeze on the snow in front of your face and form an ice mask, eventually occluding your airflow. And finally, oxygen deprivation, just from having to rebreathe the expelled air, increasing your CO2 levels until you go unconscious. So that's one of the main ways. And looking at survival rates, if someone's completely buried in an avalanche, if they're found and extricated or rescued within about 15 minutes, the survival rate is about 90%. After 30 minutes, that survival rate drops to 30%. So a quick response by your fellow parties, your fellow team members is absolutely key. And that's where we get into rescue tech, is you can have all the greatest bells and whistles, but if you don't know how to use it, if you haven't practiced with it, and if you haven't refreshed on it in a while, you know, it's a tool. That's all it is. But it's the brain is the most valuable tool that you can have, and knowing how to use that gear. The three basics: a beacon or a transceiver, and that is sending out a signal while you're skiing with your group. If you should become buried, yours stays in transmit mode. Your group switches to search mode, and they're able to hone in on a signal that is emitted, a pulse signal that is emitted from your beacon. And the technology has continued to evolve with that immensely, especially in the last 5 years. I am blown away. The new ones that we actually just got for ski patrol in Aspen, as they're on closer to your core, they can actually indicate to rescuers with similar beacons whether or not that person has a pulse and well as what that pulse approximately is. In addition to that, that technology with the beacons, it's very intuitive, but it becomes a challenge if you have more than one person buried, more than one signal being received. And that's where that training and that practice comes into play. The second thing, once you find where that person is under the snow with that beacon, then you start to probe. Because in Colorado, it's not uncommon to have people buried depending on the size of the avalanche and how deep it breaks in the snowpack. So how deep, whether it is just the top little layer, say 6 or 8 inches, or whether it goes the full 3 feet from the top of the snow all the way to the ground, people can be buried several feet and sometimes up to a meter and a half deep, if not more, in some extreme cases. So knowing how to probe, how those techniques should work, as well as practicing, what does it actually feel like to have a probe strike and hit a human and human flesh under the snow versus a tree branch or a rock? What do those different things feel like? And finally, you got to get them out. So shoveling techniques. As that snow moves down the mountain, and this is kind of the sciencey side, right? As that snow moves down the mountain, it acts very much like a liquid as it flows. And the friction of that snow grinding against itself actually will heat it up, cause the outer surface of that snow to melt. And it will then, once it comes to a rest, refreeze. Think about chipping ice off your car's windshield in the morning. That's what it can be like to dig in to a field of avalanche debris after it's set up. So being able to shovel effectively, creating a platform on the downhill side, so when that person is retrieved, you have a stable space to work on them and provide them the best chance of being resuscitated following their burial, or if nothing else, to be able to recover if they are recovered still conscious and breathing. So having the tools are great. And as well as that, Jamie, you have a couple other tools that have come onto the market in recent years, including avalanche lungs or avalungs. And we talked about that issue with the ice mask forming in front of the face or rebreathing that exhaled CO2. That avalung, you inhale on the front of the jacket, and think of it as like a snorkel. So you inhale through the front, it has a check valve, and then you exhale out the center of your back. And so it helps to prolong survival times if you were to become buried, if you can keep that snorkel in your mouth on your way down. Second thing, avalanche airbags. These aren't like airbags. These are similar to airbags in your car, I like to tell people. It doesn't guarantee your survival. It helps to increase the chances of it if you should have an incident. And those avalanche airbags, they're either compressed air cylinders or very high-powered small fans that will inflate these airbags behind the rider's head out of the top of a backpack. And so that will, one, help to reduce the trauma to the head and neck on the way down. But more importantly, think of a balloon in the water. If you release it, that the balloon, it's more buoyant than the water, wants to rise to the top. Or if you shake a mixture of peanuts and M&Ms and all kinds of goodies, I'm kind of hungry right now, so I'm thinking of like a Gorp Good Old Raisins and Peanuts mix. If you shake it, look at what rises at the top. It's those bigger pieces that rise up. That is what those avalanche airbags do, because that avalanche acts like a liquid. As you're moving down the slope, you stay closer to the top, which will decrease the depth of your burial and increase the chances of your rescuers, your companions, finding you more quickly.
Well, that raises a few questions with me, Kyle. First of all, how many people ski the backcountry by themselves so they don't have a group that looks out for them? And how many backcountry skiers actually carry some of these devices?
Well, Sam, those are numbers that I don't think we'll ever really get a good handle on. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One, I truly hope that people do not travel in the backcountry by themselves for several of the reasons that we've talked about here. But you do have those that like to go out and explore just on their own, solo, doing their thing. And I totally respect that and I understand it. But I don't think we'll ever really get those numbers. But as far as people that have these tools and technologies, I will tell you that it's actually becoming more and more common. There are more manufacturers that are making these systems, these avalanche airbags. There's many, many providers of those now. And I will also say that backcountry touring equipment, so skis that allow you to hike uphill. Think of those of you that cross-country ski. The heel, the toe is fixed and the heel is free to move up and down. Well, think of the little scales on the bottom of that cross-country ski that help to give you the push forward and they'll dig into the snow. Now think of on the bottom of your downhill ski that's normally flat and slippery, put a kind of an adhesive on it, and it has a kind of a layer that you can put on, a skin that you put on, so to speak, that has hairs that are all pointed, or little fibers pointed in one direction. So when you weight them, they dig into the snow and allow you to ascend uphill. That equipment is becoming super commonplace. Guiding groups are doing both inbounds and backcountry guided trips for those that want to experience the sport. And you can rent avalanche airbags and rent all the equipment just by simply flying to, say, for example, Denver, driving to the nearest backcountry sports store, renting the equipment without ever having any training on how to use it.
Wow. So, Joe, like you, I haven't had avalanche training in a long time, but it certainly wasn't then what it is now. What do you think of all that stuff?
Oh, I think it's amazing. You know, it's another example of how technology's pushed into both sport and the response to sport, the rescue side of things. You know, I think I would go back to my roots on that one, and it speaks loudly for the necessity of training and understanding the tools and equipment that you're working with or that you might be exposed to.
And
thoughts,
that's
Jamie.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead, Kyle.
Or Jamie.
Go ahead, Kyle.
I was just going to say with Joe's comments there, it just kind of reminds me. So I've heard, you know, Joe say it talking about training. You know, the brain is the most important tool in training your brain to recognize things that are out of the normal and trusting those gut feelings, because more often than not, if you read back on these avalanche reports where people are caught, buried, or even unfortunately killed, if you look back, it's the team dynamic, the groupthink dynamics, and people not willing to speak up and say something doesn't seem right that often precedes a catastrophic event.
Jamie, how big of an issue is that on the East Coast? I know you don't live in the mountains, but
Every time I read about avalanches, I see them as a West Coast news item. However, I'm sure there are avalanches on the East Coast and some of the mountain resorts, especially in New England, up in upstate New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, places like that. I think it's a challenge anywhere there is going to be snowpack coming, at the top of a peak, getting overweight and breaking off. Correct, Kyle?
Yes, that's the gist of it, Jamie, is you have a very strong, stable layer of snow on top of a very weak layer of snow underneath. And if you put a snowmobile or a skier on it at, just the right point, it could be anywhere on a slope. You can't point and say that place is safe, that place isn't, and you ski across there, snowmobile across it. Once you transfer that energy from the stable layer to the unstable layer, that's when bad things happen.
Yeah, all I have to worry about is getting out of my driveway. Sometimes that's a challenge. So Kyle, how many hours of training do you guys have to be avalanche qualified these days?
Well, Sam, that'll vary by agency. There are a couple of national programs, such as the American Institute for Avalanche Research and Education, or AIRE, A-I-A-R-E. They actually just redid their curriculum last season and updated it with a recreational track and a professional track that are really, really awesome for any of those that want to recreate in the backcountry or go the more professional route like ski patrollers or mountain rescue folks. As far as ski patrol, we train and refresh on our avalanche skills weekly. We kind of have different rotating topics such as single burial beacon searches, single rescuer, double beacon burial, single rescuer, triple beacon, probing techniques, shoveling techniques, right? Group leadership and directing groups of others to perform these tasks. That's a constant ongoing progression with both us and Ski Patrol, as well as with our friends in Mountain Rescue Aspen, as well as other mountain rescue teams nationwide.
And of course, there's dogs as well, avalanche dogs. That's when I first learned to love Australian Shepherds, because the resort I was working at, I got to play the person that hid in the snow or under the snow or whatever it was. Love to watch those dogs work.
Yes, absolutely. And dogs are actually, it's been proven, and we have a great thing in Colorado. I'll just touch on this. It's a team called CRAD, Colorado Rapid Avalanche Deployment, in conjunction with CareFlight out of Denver. I believe it's CareFlight. It might be Flight for Life. I'm blanking on the name. I'm sorry. It's been a long week, folks. But they actually have a partnership with the ski resorts along I-70. And so if there's a backcountry or even inbounds avalanche incident, they will fly to nearby resorts with additional resources, both handlers and dogs, pick them up and fly them right to the site so that they can more quickly locate those people. And it's been proven time and time again, especially for inbounds or near bounds avalanches, dogs are actually the most effective search tool for locating buried people.
Another tool in the arsenal. So I don't know about you, Jamie, but Joe and I, got refreshed on some things we haven't talked about in a long time. And it's nice to see all the new technology out there. What do you think?
Well, it is. And Kyle touched on some really important things about the way this is done. You know, the weekly training, the understanding how your equipment works and practicing with it regularly. Don't just say, well, I bought this last season, so I know what to do with it. And that's important, too. And it just underlines what we talk about at the end of every show. And we talk about training as being really the thing that makes the difference in so many rescue situations. And Joe has demonstrated that with the folks at Paragon Medical Education Group, that experiential training, just like Kyle was talking about, having the ski patrollers practice week in, week out, different types of skills over and over again until they're ingrained so that when the time comes, they can pass those skills along. That's the same kind of thing that Joe and his team do, is bring those people with the skills already in place that they can pass them along to your jurisdiction. So Joe, if somebody reaches out to you and wants to customize a setup or a specific training scenario, that's something that they can do, right?
Absolutely. We highly recommend that, you know, they give us a call so that we can indeed customize it to suit their needs and their students' needs.
So where can folks find you if they want to reach out to you and find out how they can get that training?
Well, come see us at ParagonMedicalGroup.com, through Facebook at Paragon Medical Group, or through the Disaster Podcast.
I keep pulling a Joe. I keep losing my mute button.
So, oh, bummer.
I know. Kyle, great information tonight. And, you know, if folks want to reach out to you and learn a little bit more about some of these things, we'll, of course, have the links that you provided in the show notes so that people can kind of look at them directly that way. But you're always available to, you know, provide people direction if they catch up with you online.
Absolutely, Jamie. I'm always happy to continue this. One clarification, it is Flight for Life. That does do the CRAD work. So shout out to those great folks. Absolutely, folks can reach out to me at wxkylenelson@gmail.com to contact me directly. Or find me on social media, direct message me, chat with me on LinkedIn. wxkylenelson is my handle there. And I'm always happy to chat with you in the Disaster Podcast Facebook group as well.
And thanks for a great episode tonight, Kyle. I was looking forward to this when I wasn't getting excited when I saw that there were some avalanche stories in the news, because that's just not right. But I was thinking this is a great topic. Something we haven't really touched on much in this show over the last few years. So I was excited to be able to bring it to the forefront.
Yes. And thank you for the opportunity. It's been a real pleasure and an honor.
Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, in all the places you can find Kyle, under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, in our Facebook group, and Kyle hangs out there if any of you have questions, and on the disasterpodcast.com website. What about you, Jamie?
Well, I'm under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations out there, so please friend, follow, or otherwise catch up with me there. And also over in our Facebook group, as Sam said, just search for Disaster Podcast on Facebook. Ask to join the group. We'd love to have you join us there and be part of the conversation, be part of the community. It's growing, it's active, and we want to have you be part of it. So please contribute and ask your questions, share your articles. That's what it's there for. Sam, this is a great topic tonight. I'm glad we took the time to get Kyle on and talk about not only the X Games and some of the things that he does there with that amazing team, but also works towards the training and expertise to manage the difficulties of avalanche rescue.
Yeah, it almost makes me miss ski patrol, but damn, it's cold. I don't miss that part. So I guess we could safely say in this case that winter medicine is not our everyday medicine.